You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll find out why France's new Prime Minister is so popular and whether he'll be able to stay that way.
I think his best chance is actually to get the government working as a team.
We'll ask if it's time we sued for peace in the war on drugs. Is the global drug trade really a consequence of our misguided attempts to stop it? Continuing the theme of transporting large quantities of grass over national borders, we'll meet the people who've grown the football pitches for Euro 2012. And we'll be talking museums and exhibitions when we're joined in the studio by our culture editor, Robert Bound. All that, plus some music too, all to come in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. So strap yourselves in, hang onto your hats and so forth. But first, the news headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The head of the United Nations Observer Mission in Syria says monitors have found 13 bodies in the east of the country. They all had their hands tied and some had been shot in the head. The UN Human Rights Council is to hold a special session this Friday to discuss last Friday's massacre in the Syrian village of Hula. 49 children and 34 women were among the 108 people killed in the massacre. The UN says most were killed in their own homes. Meanwhile, UN diplomats have said they fear the 14-month-old uprising is unlikely to stop without political negotiations between the government and opposition. The former Liberian president Charles Taylor has been jailed for 50 years by a special war crimes court for helping Sierra Leonean rebels wage a savage war. Mr. Taylor, the first head of state convicted by an international court since the World War II, had been found guilty of backing rebels who murdered, raped and mutilated tens of thousands of people in an 11-year war that ended in 2002. Aboubakar Korome, originally from Sierra Leone but now living in the Netherlands, welcomed the decision even though he was hoping for a longer sentence.
The judges have created a kind of landmark decision, and as far as I'm concerned. As I said, we were expecting more, the 80 years. We were expecting that 80 years, but now we have to respect the outcome as well, the 50 years.
Yeah. EU Commission President José Manuel Barroso has said the Eurozone should have a banking union, joint financial supervision and bank deposit guarantees as elements of a deeper economic union that European Union leaders will discuss in June. The EU executive was releasing recommendations for all 27 European Union countries, an event that has become increasingly important since the Eurozone faced the worst crisis of its history. Mr. Barroso explained the Commission's approach to reporters.
We intend to look at the further steps we need to take towards a full economic union to complete our monetary union. The Commission will advocate an ambitious approach. The building blocks could include, among others, a banking union with integrated financial supervision and single deposit guarantee scheme.
These two new ideas come on top of the issue of Eurobonds, a way to mutualise European debt. British Prime Minister David Cameron's former press spokesman Andy Coulson has been arrested by police investigating allegations of perjury. He's suspected of committing perjury during the trial of the former member of the Scottish Parliament, Tommy Sheridan, in 2010. He was detained at his home in South London and is being taken to Glasgow for questioning. Pope Benedict has broken his silence on the Vatican leak scandal, expressing his anger at the way some parts of the media are covering the story. He said exaggerated and gratuitous reports were painting a false image of the Holy See. Meanwhile, at a press briefing in the Vatican today, spokesman Father Federico Lombardi confirmed that there were intensive investigations into the leaks of sensitive documents, but that he was unwilling to make further comments until he knew the outcome of those investigations. French reporter Frédéric Mounier said the Pope had effectively issued a warning to the press.
Well, today the main point was the Pope's reaction after the burglary of his office. He said that he renewed his confidence to the people who work with him, and he said that the journalists should take care and not go too far away from the different real facts.
Officials in Pakistan have said the doctor who helped the United States find Osama bin Laden has been imprisoned for aiding militants and not for his links to the CIA. A court in the Khyber tribal region near the Afghan border jailed the man, Dr. Shakil Afridi, for 33 years last week. Pakistani officials had first said the decision was based on treason charges for aiding the CIA in its hunt for the Al-Qaeda chief. Correspondents say there was a lot of friction between Pakistan and the United States over this case, and that the change of reason for Dr. Afridi's imprisonment maybe an effort to improve relations with Washington. And those are the main stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. Approaching 6 minutes past the hour here at Midori House, and you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 podcast, yeah.
Monocle 24 is your episode.
This is Monocle 24.
Tama on Monocle Coxigumataneria.
Dobro pozdravat. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House live from Studio One in London. Now, any dispassionate assessment of the global war on drugs can only conclude that the drugs are winning. Around the world, billions are spent and millions are imprisoned, and yet illegal drugs remain efficiently supplied and enthusiastically consumed. According to the US government's National Survey on Drug Use in 2010, 22 million Americans, that's around 9% of the population, used illegal drugs, and that was only the ones who'd admit to it. In South America, source of much of what North America smokes or snorts, there is a gathering clamour for a new approach. Several heads of government have openly discussed decriminalisation, and last week a group of Brazilian judges proposed in a letter to be sent to Brazil's Congress that all drugs be decriminalised. Joining me now is Tom Blickman. He's a senior researcher with the Drugs and Democracy Programme at the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. Good evening.
Good evening.
Tom, if the war on drugs is being lost, why are we still fighting it?
Well, that's the $60 million question, of course.
If only it was as cheap as $60 million.
Well, the point, of course, is if we would look for a rational answer, we wouldn't be fighting this war. But the thing is, it's so emotional, it's so mixed up with moral issues that it's very difficult for rational arguments to come through in the whole discussion about the war on drugs.
Well, this is obviously the case. I mean, you would think that in a global problem like this, America especially, given that it's one of the most enthusiastic consumers, would have to take the lead on this. And yet any American president who even raised the issue would be pretty much instantly destroyed, you would think. You're based in Amsterdam, which of course has for many decades served as something of a test case for a more liberal approach to drugs. What do you think have been the upsides of it for your city?
Well, what you can mostly about cannabis, of course. I think what you could see in Amsterdam or generally around in the Netherlands is that there is a much more relaxed attitude towards cannabis. I always compare it to the forbidden fruit question. If a fruit is forbidden, it's much more attractive, especially for young people. So if it's more normalized, if we don't make a big fuss about it, if we give the right information that there are, of course, also risks associated with cannabis use, youngsters and people more in general are more relaxed about it, and it's not such a big deal anymore. And so people are normally around it.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that America in particular would have learned something from its catastrophic experiment with banning alcohol in the 1920s, which of course created a massive underground criminal network, which has been paralleled by what we've seen with drugs, especially in South America. How damaging is the drug trade and the illegality of it in those countries that are now discussing decriminalization?
It's pretty damaging. If you look at Mexico, there are, over the past 6 years with the last president, Calderon, there have been 50,000 people dead in relation to drug war. If you look to Guatemala, Central America, the situation is even worse. What you can see is an overburdened criminal justice system. There's a overburdened jail system. Many people in jail that shouldn't be there. It's quite a burden for Latin American societies, and it doesn't really solve anything. Mostly, there have been the model they have been shown and basically imposed upon it by the United States is not working, and now slowly you can see that Latin American countries are looking for a different approach, an approach that is less punitive, less repressive, and it's more like a public health approach to the issue. For instance, you can see now in what you mentioned in Brazil, that they want to decriminalize possession for personal use, even cultivation of cannabis for personal use. You see the same thing happening in Uruguay and in Argentina. There are now, in all these countries, there are now laws in parliament. They still have to be approved, but they're proposed to try to find a solution in this way.
You mentioned earlier that there's a lack of rational discussion of this, that it all tends to get very emotional very, very quickly, especially in the United States, and you are, of course, right. But do you think this gathering sort of body of quite serious people, I mean, this is heads of government and heads of state, it's not kind of, you know, sandal-shod left-wing campaigners anymore. Do you think that might alter the tone of the discussion in the places where it really matters, which I guess is in the places where people consume drugs, Europe and the United States?
Well, let's hope so. You can also see in the United States itself that attitudes are changing. The latest poll showed that at least more than 50%, I think the right number was 56%, of people in the United States are favoring regulating cannabis, just like alcohol or tobacco. And you can also see that this is especially more popular among young people. So this is going to be an issue in the United States as well. And even this year, when there will be ballots in both Washington State and Colorado on regulating cannabis as like alcohol or tobacco. And if they win in those states, that would be an interesting test case between state rights and the rights and the federal government on how to go on this issue. And let's be honest, I mean, we just see the latest biography of Obama. He was an enthusiastic marijuana smoker as well. So also, I think there will be a change of attitude in the United States. It will take a while. People have to basically get to they're addicted to prohibition in a sense, so they have to be detoxified in that sense.
Just finally, though, we talked earlier about your city, Amsterdam, as a test case. Are people in Amsterdam as enthusiastic about this liberal approach as they always have been? Of course, last month, a ban was instituted keeping foreigners out of Amsterdam coffee shops.
Well, not Amsterdam yet. The ban is now...
In other Dutch coffee shops.
Yeah, in the southern provinces. It will be on January 1, 2013, it will also be applied in Amsterdam. In Amsterdam, basically, it's not such a problem. People can get annoyed every once in a while of too many tourists, but it's not really a problem. In the southern cities, in Maastricht and other cities in the south, it's more of a problem. The cities are smaller, and there are many Belgians, French, and German people buying cannabis over there. So, but the measures now in place are not going to solve that problem. I mean, basically, what has to be done is that people in the politicians in Belgium and Germany wise up and start to implement the same kind of system as in the Netherlands, so that we don't have the problem of of cannabis users buying their stuff in the Netherlands. What Germany, France, and Belgium are basically doing is closing their eyes for the problem they have at home and leave it up to the Dutch to solve it.
Tom Blickman of the Drugs and Democracy Program at the Transnational Institute, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Ahead of this month's publication of Monocle's annual Quality of Life issue, all next week we'll be broadcasting a series of special roundtable discussions on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different Monocle editor each day, they'll cover everything from a debate on the future of the suburb to a show about simplicity in design. Airing at 2300 hours every day next week, that's the Quality of Life series here on Monocle 24.
On the latest episode of Section D, we scale the heights of the Tokyo Sky Tree, talk bentwood furniture with Mr. Philip Tonnet, and fashion graduates with Wendy Dagworthy from the RCA.
I think what we do is really encourage students to be themselves, so they've really got to love and have a passion for what they do.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House Live from Studio One in London. It's time now for our first song of the show. This is White Denim with Keys.
I've got a number of keys, no doors to unlock. There's a hole in my wall that lacks the capacity to shock.
Was Keys by White Denim. It's 21 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House. If France's newly appointed Prime Minister, Jean-Marc Ayrault, accomplishes nothing else during his tenure, he will at least be able to claim that he made a heck of a first impression. After less than a fortnight in the job, he's the most popular incoming Prime Minister in 50 years, scoring a 65% approval rating in the polls. This will be a difficult standard for the former mayor of Nantes to maintain, at least without getting himself burnt at the stake by English bishops. Joan of Arc jokes too soon? Tough crowd. Earlier today, I discussed the rise of Ayrault with legendary journalist and regular contributor to Monocle 24, Christine Ockrent. I began by asking whether Ayrault was merely benefiting from the fact that he hadn't yet been in office long enough to upset anybody.
Well, as you say, you know, 15 minutes in the job, he was still extremely popular. what is interesting about Jean-Marc Ayrault is that he looks the perfect part as the sort of counter-hero to Nicolas Sarkozy. You know, the French were tired of Sarkozy's energy and perpetual agitation. And Ayrault, together with the new president, but Ayrault particularly, is a very calm, quiet, ponderous guy. And, of course, both of them, they haven't touched upon the real hot issues. Ayrault gathered all the trade union leaders yesterday, and it it was a very nice meeting. Everybody was very happy to go to his office and to come out of his office saying how marvelous. But they only talked about the way they would eventually work together. It was all about, you know, process and methods and not the nitty-gritty and the real stuff. So, again, I think Hérault has a very good image. Mind you, François Fillon, the previous prime minister, who stayed 5 years under Sarkozy, Fillon was also quite popular. In fact, he was more popular than his president.
Another thing that Hérault has in common with Hollande is that he's never held any ministerial office. Was he a surprising choice as prime minister?
Actually, Hérault was not a surprise because he's been very close to Hollande for years. And Hollande is known to not to take chances with people. When you look at his government or indeed at his own team at the Élysée, he's chosen people he's known for 40 years. You know, the most, most of them coming from the ENA and from the same year, the same promotion that he was in. Hérault has always been close to Hollande politically and also personally, and so there was some argument as to whether Martine Aubry, who is the leader of the Socialist Party, would eventually have wanted the job. But Hollande and Aubry are famous for not getting along. And so it became quite obvious that Hollande would go for Hérault. And indeed, it was no major surprise.
There's a lot of the early coverage of Hérault has focused on the role he might be able to play in strengthening France's relationship with Germany. He's a sort of expert on Germany. He speaks fluent German. What are his other perceived strengths?
Well, Hérault used to teach German. So indeed he speaks German, but it is not his primary task. You know, it's not the prime minister who is actually in charge of European matters, and it is not up to him to negotiate with Madame Merkel's people in Berlin. So Hérault is seen as a very good connoisseur of the French parliamentary system. And that, of course, is quite important, as indeed we have parliamentary elections coming up in about 10 days. Nobody seems to care much except those who want to be elected. But there is indeed an election, which is important in political terms for Hollande and Hérault, because that will determine how much of a margin of maneuver they have in parliament to actually conduct the policy.
And what about his weaknesses? He obviously has this 15-year-old scandal hanging over him, the suspended sentence he received over the fiddling of a local newspaper printing contract. Has he been generally forgiven for that?
Well, frankly, it's not a major scandal. It's some sort of mishandling. There was some sort of a trial. There was a sentence. It's quite minor compared to, you know, many other wrongdoings by local politicians, not always observing the rules. So it is not held against him. I think that most people actually in France don't even know about it. About that particular fact. No, he's known to have been a very good mayor of Nantes, which is a booming city in Brittany, in the west of the country, and a very apolitical one, not an ideological guy, you know, getting along with all sorts of people and not having a politicized approach to local issues. And I think that is why the French on the whole, who didn't really know much about him, perceive him as a perfectly palatable guy until of course, the moment comes where the situation may get a bit more difficult, both for the Prime Minister and for the President.
Well, just finally then, as he settles into his new job, what are the things he can do that give him his best chance of preserving his fabulous popularity rating?
I think his best chance is actually to get the government working as a team. That was one of Sarkozy's main weaknesses. First of all, Sarkozy wanted to do everything himself, not only being the president, but also being the prime minister, and in turn playing, you know, every other job, minister of foreign affairs, minister of the economy, and so on and so forth. So I think Ayrault's main asset would be to be a very good team leader. And indeed, he has already imposed upon some of the most, media-hungry members of his government. He's already told them, sit still, don't think you're so interesting all by yourself. And I'm the boss, and we have to work as a team. And I think that will be the test for Ayrault, and I think he has a good chance, you know, to pass that test.
That was Christine Ockrent speaking to me earlier about France's thus far popular new prime minister. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
LDN TYO NYC MT4.
And in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be heading to Austria to hear about the business of turfing, and we'll be talking museums, exhibitions, and whatever else leaps to mind with our culture editor, Robert Bound. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the headlines.
The head of the United Nations observer mission in Syria says monitors have found 13 bodies in the east of the country. They all had their hands tied and some had been shot in the head. The UN Human Rights Council is to hold a special session this Friday to discuss last Friday's massacre in the Syrian village of Hula. 49 children and 34 women were among the 108 people killed in the massacre. The former Liberian President Charles Taylor has been jailed for 50 years by a special war crimes court for helping Sierra Leonean rebels wage a savage war. Mr. Taylor, the first head of state convicted by an international court since World War II, had been found guilty of backing rebels who murdered, raped and mutilated tens of thousands of people in an 11-year war that ended in 2002. The EU Commission President José Manuel Barroso has said the Eurozone should have a banking union, joint financial supervision and bank deposit guarantees as elements of a deeper economic union that European Union leaders will discuss in June. The EU executive was releasing recommendations for all 27 European Union countries, an event that has become increasingly important since the Eurozone faced the world's crisis of its history. British Prime Minister David Cameron's former press spokesman Andy Coulson has been arrested by police investigating allegations of perjury. He's suspected of committing perjury during the trial of the former member of the Scottish Parliament, Tommy Sheridan, in 2010. He was detained at his home in South London and was taken to Glasgow for questioning. Pope Benedict has broken his silence on the Vatican leak scandal, expressing his anger at the way some parts of the media are covering the story. He said exaggerated and gratuitous reports were painting a false image of the Holy See. Officials in Pakistan have said the doctor who helped the United States find Osama bin Laden has been imprisoned for aiding militants and not for his links to the CIA. A court in the Khyber tribal region near the Afghan border jailed the man, Dr. Shakil Afridi, for 33 years last week. Those are the main stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. Now, every day on Midori House, we summon one of Monocle's section editors from the floor upstairs. And it's Wednesday, and that means it's the culture editor's turn. And our culture editor is Robert Bound, who joins me now.
Hi, Andrew.
Good
How's
evening.
It going?
It's very well. You're looking suspiciously tanned.
That's the sort of hangover. That
really?
gives you it's so strong that it gives you a tan.
Wow.
Actually, I'm joking. No, it's good. It's a bit Cuba and a bit of English summer.
Okay.
Have you noticed that James, when he's reading the news, draws the most intricate Grand Prix tracks on his script?
Is that what he's doing?
It's really amazing. I've never seen anything like it.
Are they actually Formula One circuits?
I don't know whether they are.
Is he just drawing
approximations?
Sort of
Maybe they're scale electric circuits, but not quite Formula One.
It would be quite eerie if it turned out they were actual.
It's a perfect Formula scale model of like Silverstone.
Or... I'm going to ask him about that.
Yeah.
Next time he's in here. I would say we've drifted from our subject slightly, but we haven't actually got on to our subject.
Well, it's all about drawing a bit, isn't it?
Okay.
I wanted to talk to you. I'm willing to go with this. This is your link, Rob. Make it work. I wanted to kick off and tell you about the summer exhibition which opened today.
Is there drawing in it?
There is drawing in it.
Seamless.
There is painting in it. There is sculpture in it. There are lithographs in it. There's all sorts of stuff. Scribbles, scrolls, good stuff, bad stuff. The summer exhibition has been going since 1769 at the Royal Academy in Piccadilly. And it is this thing that sort of had a great reputation as showing the works of masters, British masters, and then sort of became a bit of a Sunday watercolourists kind of playground, you know, the kind of things that lean very near to the Royal Academy up against the railings on Green Park on a Sunday morning. And it seems to have, it sort of goes in fits and spurts, and it's one of those things that there's a lot of kind of crap in with the great stuff. But it's also a great kind of place. It's a very democratic thing. People, there's over 1,000 works of art in the show, and people, anyone, you and I, anyone else, whether you're a Royal Academician or a Sunday painter.
Or a newsreader.
Or a newsreader.
Yeah.
Who's got a sort of Grand Prix track fetish. anyone can enter and potentially get their stuff up on the walls. And there's a new curator or a coordinator. I don't think it's actually physically curated this year. And she has painted some of the walls and done some different things and slightly mixed it up. But it's a kind of joy. It's one of those. It's a slow kind of. It's like a kind of being in a raft on a slow moving river.
Does it get a huge crowd still?
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty popular because it's the sort of thing. People go because they can kind of pick up what is a bargain, potentially, or they can pick up a really nice painting. I've bought a couple of things there in the last couple of years because you can buy nice things that fill a nice space on your wall, and for 500 quid or a grand, it's quite nice.
What have you bought recently?
I bought a thing called The Incredible Hulk, which is a self-portrait of an artist called Dan Bratby, whose father's a Royal Academician, and it's a self-portrait of a slightly... a man with what might be a split personality or complications. Maybe he has anger problems. I have it in my living room to remind me every day.
it's not actually a portrait of an over-muscled, enormous green ogre.
No, it's not.
Okay.
He's more Bruce Banner.
I was
going to
say, that'd be a coincidence because I've got that in my living room.
Hooray! Yeah. A cardboard cutout.
Yeah, indeed.
So that was this morning. That was very good. That runs, by the way, until midway through August. It's the big summer thing. It's always the big jamboree. Lots of kind of hyacinth bouquet types from the home counties will come up and see it. But then, as I say, it's kind of everyone, every slightly snobbish art critic, and everyone always sneaks in and has a look at it to see. It's also got big name artist Tracy Emin has work in it. Michael Craig Martin has work in it. Humphrey Ocean has work in it. All of them Royal Academicians. And it's sort of a must-see or a sneak in.
Okay.
Maybe leave with something under your arm. Only you have to pick it up only when the whole show is finished. You can't just sort of nab things off the walls as you go.
Okay. Well, that sounds like fun.
It is good. It's a good democratic art day out. That.
Okay. What else has attracted your attention?
And then, earlier today, for next week's Culture Roundtable, I interviewed James Brett, who's the founder of the Museum of Everything in London, which was... He's great at using weird spaces. He had a converted dairy in Primrose Hill that he turned into a gallery for his art, which is a sort of, or his collection, which is a bit of a curiosity shop, but it's also outsider art. So it's artists by people that perhaps don't know they're making art. People in mental hospitals, people who make stuff in their gardens, weird stuff, but really rather brilliant stuff often. And that's the Museum of Everything. And
so is something art if the person creating it is not intending to create art?
Well, that's a great question. And also, I'd wonder whether everything an artist does is art.
Mm.
Should we have a big pause there? Just let people mull that.
Everybody just take 5 seconds to think about that one.
Which time zone do you think is best suited to be thinking about this sort of thing? At what time of the day?
It would be a really good one to get confronted with when you've either just woken up or haven't been to bed in far too long.
Yes.
So it's a kind of thing that's just going to just set people...
I can empathise with that.
Wow.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing you don't want to really mull over until at least you've brushed your teeth.
No, I think it's the one best mulled over when completely unprepared.
All right.
Actually.
and so this thing has become rather famous, and he's toured it. It was in Tate Modern, and he's toured it in various places. This summer, he's making a huge red truck, and he's driving around Russia with a tannoy on top of it, shouting, "Bring out your art! Bring out your art! We want your art! Bring out your art! Whoever you are!"
And what he's going to possibly go wrong.
Precisely, and yep. It did venture that it might be a dangerous thing, and he said that he was thinking that he probably would get an armed policeman to drive the truck, not himself.
Okay. And also wanted to ask you about the musical guest on your culture show this week, I was excited about, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you, Andrew, for putting this together and interviewing Jason Isbell, who I think was over in his own right, but he's of a similar ilk to a Ryan Adams.
He was actually in London opening for Ryan Adams at the Palladium.
Yeah, and I think we're going to hear a track. This was you interviewed him, and he played four tracks on this week's Culture Show.
Yep, which is available for podcast or download and all of that stuff.
Out now.
It is. Shall I introduce it?
Yeah.
This is Jason Isbell, formerly of Drive-By Truckers. It's the opening track from his new album, Here We Rest, and this is him live in the studio here at Midori House with Alabama Pines.
All right. This one is called Alabama Pines. Well, I moved into this room, if you could call it that, a week. The liberties that we came to without seem to disappear like ghosts in the air. We don't even care, truly vanishes away.
Gorgeous song, Alabama Pines by Jason Isbell, live in the studio here. That's from his new album, Here We Rest. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture, from the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Long overshadowed by its neighbors, Seoul's creative community is flourishing as a new generation of designers are developing new projects and pieces. Monocle's Gabriel Lee traveled to South Korea to meet some of the people leading the charge.
Indeed, many in the creative community here have studied or worked abroad and now come back, melding their experience in the world with a Korean aesthetic and creating something new and appealing. This is the first generation to have done this on such a scale.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films, from affairs to business, culture to design, in the program's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House. Though this summer's European Football Championships will take place within the borders of Poland and Ukraine, the games will be played on Austrian soil. The turf between the goalposts is being provided by Richter Rasen, a century-old family company based in Baden, which supplies football pitches and other sporting surfaces to venues all over the world. And joining me now is one of the very few Austrians who will be taking part in the tournament, Richter Rasen Managing Director Alexander Richter. Good evening.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear that the actual turf for a football tournament would come from another country entirely. What is your company able to provide that Poland and Ukraine couldn't?
I would say, as you see, natural turf is a biological system, and you want to understand that properly, and then you can create a very good product from that.
And
I think we have understood what to do, what to provide for the game of football.
So what particular qualities does your turf have that, you know, that's necessary to play good football on?
Yeah, the turf is consisting first of the soil, as you said. By the way, it's not our Austrian soil. It's from our farm in Slovakia, here in Centrope.
Okay.
And the second point is, the soil has to have some characteristics which are good for the game, like shared tolerance, water infiltration, and all that. By the other hand, the good grass has to grow in that, in there, and of course you need a good maintenance as well to provide the product. We are working 2 years to get it done.
And once at the end of that two-year process, how do you go about transporting the grass from Slovakia to the venues in Poland and Ukraine?
That's done with frigo trucks, refrigerated trucks. It's not that far because, you know, we are sort of 1,500 kilometers away from Kiev or Donetsk, a little more. So it's not that far. It's a 2-3 day transport period.
And how many trucks are you sending?
One stadium usually takes 28 to 30 trucks. So one field is rolling in a few days away from our farm to the stadium venues.
And the actual turf, how delicate is it? I mean, how exact are the conditions that you need to transport it in?
Yeah, it depends to the time when we're harvesting. Means when the temperatures are high in summertime, we have to cool it down to sort of under zero. But in the cooler season, when it's autumn or wintertime, it's easier. So we can go over zero.
And will you be sending a lot of your own people to the grounds in Poland and Ukraine during the tournament to make sure the turf is doing what it should do?
Yeah, we have been cooperating very well with local and international business partners in this project. So it was just us monitoring delivery and installation of our turf rolls. But the field construction and installation has been done with our partners.
Okay, and once the turf is actually laid in the venue, what can still go wrong with it? What kind of things are you looking out for at that point?
Yeah, the biggest issue always is transport, because the turf is good after two plus years in our farm. We know that because there was long testing done by UEFA and consultants to see what is the turf quality. But the transport is the big issue between our farm and the stadium. So if there is something going wrong, we are in trouble.
And before the kickoff of the first game, will you be nervous or confident?
Confident, because we know everything already. It's good fields we have there in Kiev, in Lviv, and in Donetsk. So we have done them already properly, so I can sit down very relaxed and watch the games.
Alexander Richter of Richter Rasen, enjoy Euro 2012 taking place on your turf. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And time now for our last song of the evening, and maintaining the theme established in that item, this is recent Midori House session guest Todd Snyder with Keep Off the Grass.
Keeps on getting harder to keep on keeping on with everybody. So I keep an open mind. It's a closed-minded world, always telling me to keep off the grass.
That was the very great Todd Snyder with Keep Off the Grass. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. A gathering body of thought wonders if our nearest neighbours might be found on Europa, one of the 64 moons that orbits Jupiter. Earlier this month, the European Space Agency approved the billion-euro JUICE project, a 4.8-tonne unmanned Jupiter probe to launch in 2022, scheduled to reach the vicinity of Jupiter in 2030. To find out more about this, Ted Kravitz and I spoke earlier with Ian O'Neill, the author, astrophysicist and founder of the Astro Engine website. We started by asking Ian what the difference was between the ESA's new initiative and the NASA probe Juno.
The Yeah, the key thing is, I mean, with Juno, Juno is going to actually establish a polar orbit around Jupiter, and it's going to be arriving, I think, in 2016. So it's fairly close. It's going to be doing a flyby of the Earth to gravitationally slingshot it back out into space in 2013, and it'll arrive in Jupiter orbit in 2016. And it's basically going to really focus on the planet as a whole, rather than its moons. As you say, there's 64 moons in orbit around Jupiter. So the European mission that's going to be launching, I think, in how many years' time? Probably 10 years' time, and it won't actually arrive in Jupiter orbit until 2030, I think. At that mission, the JUICE mission is actually going to be investigating the moons themselves. And as you say, there's a few moons there that are very exciting, especially Europa. It has the potential to have life underneath its icy crust.
How do they have the potential to have life underneath their icy crust? How do we know that?
Well, we know there's compelling evidence, basically, for subsurface oceans. And these are basically liquid water. And as it turns out, Europa has got a similar amount of water underneath its icy crust as Earth has. So this is quite a substantial moon. It's probably around about, it's a little bit smaller than our moon, but it's got a huge amount of water. And basically, as it orbits Jupiter, the tidal pushing and pulling of Jupiter causes internal heating, which actually keeps this icy moon quite warm on the inside. So it actually has internal heating. So although it's very icy on the surface, it actually looks like it's got a water interior. So it's basically got a subsurface ocean. And from previous observations of this moon, it looks like the surface layer is actually replenished on quite a regular basis because there's hardly any craters. So it's basically this cue ball, this very smooth cue ball with a very cracked surface. And this suggests that there's an internal dynamo of heat that's churning this internal ocean. And within this icy crust, there's also these lakes. Now, the indication of these lakes suggests that there is some sort of circulation through the ice as well, which means there could be oxygen circulation within this subterranean ocean, which is very exciting for people hunting for life.
Well, when we talk about that life potentially existing in a place like Europa or perhaps on a couple of their other moons, like Callisto and Ganymede, which are also believed to have subterranean lakes, what kind of life are we envisaging?
This is the exciting thing. I mean, this is all speculation. I mean, we can't
obviously
say that. Yeah, it's very difficult when the scientists come forward and say, look, there's a potential for life here. It may not be life as we know it, but it certainly has the chemical compositions, and it certainly has the potential for a nice habitat, a warm habitat for, you know, basic bacterial life to survive. So this is like microbial life. And there is a precedent for that on Earth around oceanic vents along volcanic ruptures on the surface, on the base of the ocean. There are extremophiles, basically these microbes that can withstand extreme heat, and they survive by drawing energy from this geological heat coming up through the crust of the Earth. Now, a similar thing is thought to be, if like Europa is actually being heated from the core outwards, there could be these deep ocean vents which provide energy to these microbes. And so this is where the speculation's really begun. Basically, there could, if the chemicals are there to form life, there is certainly an energy source to perhaps provide energy to these extreme forms of life. And as I said, if there is the circulation of oxygen within this subsurface ocean, perhaps even more complex forms of life could survive. And there's been some speculation in the past, most notably by Richard Greenberg. He's actually a specialist in Europa. He's saying that there's enough oxygen within the subsurface ocean that complex life forms could survive. So we're talking like jellyfish, like alien jellyfish. That's the kind of things that he's talking about. Again, speculation, but it's certainly very exciting to talk about.
Do you ever consider at all what the philosophical ramifications might be of confirming that we are, in fact, not alone in the universe? Don't you worry about sort of freaking humanity out massively?
I don't know. It's hard to say how we'd react, but I consider the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and certainly the search for life just in general elsewhere beyond Earth, I see that as one of the most noble efforts we can do. It's it's one of the biggest unknown questions as to whether life on Earth is it. And I find it more lonely and a little bit more petrifying to find that if we are the only life forms out there. So for me personally, if we could discover, even if it's microbial life on Mars, that would be thrilling. Even if it's ancient life, at least we know that life can form elsewhere in this, in our solar system, and if not beyond. And that's, I find that a very exciting prospect. But then again, there's probably a lot of people who would be quite freaked out by it, obviously. But we don't have to worry about being invaded by any of these creatures yet, because at the moment it looks like we're totally alone, which is kind of, you know, lonely.
That was astrophysicist Ian O'Neill talking about the tantalising prospects of alien jellyfish. You're listening to Midori House. And that's all we have time for today. Thank you to our producer, Dawn Trump, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager today, Toby Hammond. I've been Andrew Muller. Thank you very much for listening, and come back in 3 hours from now for The Daily. See you later.